refugee population. Afghan refugees have, over the past four decades of war, found safe havens, not in the US or Europe, but across the border in Iran and Pakistan. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, around 90% of Afghan refugees worldwide live in these two countries. Iran, which shares a 572-mile border with Afghanistan, has maintained a consistent policy vis-à-vis Afghan refugees. The country is home to around 1 million documented and 2 million undocumented Afghan refugees, and continues to provide hope to Afghan asylum seekers rejected by the West. In recent weeks, with thousands of Afghans fleeing the chaos in their country, Iran has set up temporary refugee camps in three border provinces. This despite economic pressure from crippling US sanctions. Another country is Pakistan, which shares a 1,640-mile border with Afghanistan. It has hosted almost 3 million Afghan refugees since the 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, who were scattered across Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan provinces bordering Afghanistan. At present, there are two key border crossing points between the two countries. Despite the initial hesitance, a large number of Afghan refugees have crossed into Pakistan in recent weeks, especially after the carnage near the Kabul airport.
The international community must recognize that we are hosting these refugees since decades, and this is not a matter of days and months. So the international community, and particularly the global institutions, particularly the UNHCR and many other institutions which are looking at the humanitarian affairs in Afghanistan, they need to speak up on that. And for this, the Afghan refugees themselves need to speak on that. And we should raise that voices at multiple platforms, and we must force the Western media and the others to force their governments to take initiative so that Pakistan and Iran and other countries who are hosting refugees, they're paid back in some way.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Ashok Swain, Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at the Uppsala University in Sweden. Professor Swain, so glad to have you here on the program. First of all, we want to know if this crisis, the tens of thousands of Afghans who are scrambling to flee the country, could this have been avoided in the first place?
Yes, I think in one sense, probably the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan could have been managed better. But to be honest, any sort of troop withdrawals after a defeat or accepting a defeat is always messy, and it became messier because the fall of the Afghan government in a very quick time. So it surprised everyone. It could have been possibly, if they would have imagined before, they could have taken some kind of measures which probably would have been a bit more orderly. But at present, I think it was also somehow a little bit inevitable what we are witnessing now.
Professor, the new mass exodus of Afghans is now fast snowballing into a major humanitarian crisis. Would you hold the foreign powers who led the 20-year failed war in the country responsible for the chaos?
Yes, of course, because as you know, Afghanistan is going through a violent conflicts of some sort for the more than four decades now. But at least for the last two decades, when the international community, particularly after overthrowing Taliban regime in 2001, it promised that it is going to build Afghanistan, all these kind of more than $2.3 trillion were in the name of Afghanistan were spent, 20 years were kept Afghanistan under a puppet government. But what had happened in Afghanistan? We saw the poverty doubled. The poverty, people living under poverty has doubled. At present, one third of Afghan population need food assistance because they are suffering from human food scarcity. Half of the Afghan people do not have drinking water. Two-thirds of Afghans don't have electricity. So what we have done in the last 20 years in the international community being involved and with the huge amount, number of loss of life, both by in Afghanistan and outside, huge amount of money spent, but what has happened? Nothing.
Now let's pause the questions and take a look at how the global media has covered the new Afghan refugee crisis sparked by the shocking turn of events in recent weeks.
For the Afghan people, what the Biden administration has done is make things even worse. The chaotic scene at Kabul's international airport proves that the remaining U.S. troops are not in the least prepared to control the situation in Afghanistan after their withdrawal. In the end, U.S. military forces will take thousands of Afghan people to the U.S. through the so-called Special Immigrant Visas Program for Afghans. But the refugee problem of Afghanistan will bring endless troubles to its neighboring countries. The current wave of Afghan refugees should also be seen within the context of the earlier waves who tried to escape conflict, persecution, and violence in their country. Population movement out of Afghanistan has been a consistent phenomenon of its history over the past 40 years. Yet many fleeing today are the ones who returned to Afghanistan post-2001, having trusted the international community and its commitment towards Afghans and Afghanistan. They, unlike their predecessors, feel betrayed. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, says that as many as 500,000 people are ready to flee Afghanistan in the coming months in a worst-case scenario. According to the UN agency, there are already around 2.2 million Afghans who are registered as refugees abroad, the vast majority of them in neighboring Iran and Pakistan. But the actual numbers of Afghans in both countries is likely much, much higher when undocumented Afghans are included.
Several European countries have continued to deport Afghan refugees over the years, and again, they are cold-shouldering refugees and migrants from Afghanistan. What's your take on this act of negligence?
Yeah, it's a sort of double standard has been maintained. Of course, you know, there have been some countries in Europe. They have taken more refugees than others, and refugee issue has, particularly Germany and Sweden, but the refugee issue have divided almost or even collapsed the European Union unity for 5 years back when the Syrian crisis was taking place. But in the last 2 years, there are more Afghan refugees coming to Europe than from Syria. So the number has increased for a long period of time. But still, they were trying to push Afghan refugees back to their country. There have been a huge politics is going on in the Europe with the rise of populist nationalism. This is becoming more and more issue. And I think they don't understand that the large number of Afghan refugees live in the neighboring countries rather than coming anywhere.
And what about Iran and Pakistan? They already host around 90% of Afghan refugees. Now that more are coming, especially those turned away by the West, why don't we hear anything about it in the Western media?
As I said, if you look at the refugee number, most of the refugees live in the developing countries or next to their conflict, where the conflict takes place. But those refugees never come to the media attention, and there is a small number which comes to the West, makes such a huge news because of this But there has been, it's a huge politicization taking place. Media gets very highly engaged, and those kind of issues needs to be seriously reflected upon. Needs to look at, as you mentioned, Afghanistan refugees for the last, again, for 40 years, have been living quite close to both in Iran as well as in Pakistan, and all 90% of it. But other countries have very, very small number of refugees living. These countries, those who claim to have a moral authority and power, and also really creating this kind of conflict-led disaster, which really leading to these refugee issues, but are not accepting refugees.
The post 9/11 wars by the US have displaced at least 38 million people in countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Pakistan. Now, Professor, do you believe the US owes reparations to these war-stricken people?
I think this is, as I said, the countries have, those who have been engaged in the war in other parts of the world, do not take the responsibility, the kind of humanitarian disaster, the humanitarian crisis they bring to these countries. There have been a huge humanitarian catastrophe have been due to of these regions. But of course, there is no such thing at place to take actions against those who are committing these kind of atrocities against the people. And I think this is absolutely, again, it's true, we international community is failing in that sense, that or stopping these kind of things repeating itself.
There you have it, Professor Swain from the Uppsala University in Sweden. Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, Professor. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on Afghanistan's refugee crisis that is snowballing into a major humanitarian catastrophe.
Ahmad Shah Katawazai, an Afghan-American diplomat, blames the refugee crisis in Afghanistan on the international community apart from the Afghan political leadership. US-based Muslim preacher and author Omar Soleiman appeals for help to Afghan refugees, says they have for years been bombed, abandoned, and betrayed. American journalist Steph Kite, pointing to the worsening refugee crisis, says many countries are preemptively shutting their doors to Afghan refugees. Bruno Miquez, a Portuguese politician and author, paints a vivid picture of situation in Kabul, with desperate Afghans seeking evacuation amid rocket and drone attacks. Former Afghan government official Zara Akbari says no one wants to abandon home, and Afghans simply demand evacuation of refugees the United States created.
And that was our episode on Afghanistan's new refugee crisis engineered by the US and its allies, and also the reckless response of Western countries to this major humanitarian crisis. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadli, and you're listening to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalamu wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today is we will deal with a question that is often posed to the Shia Muslim believers of Islam. And the question is as follows. Isn't 1,400 years of repetitive crying and mourning for the tragedy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam not enough? The question is, do we not tire of crying for the Imam? What do you say, dear Sheikh? Do we tire from crying for the Imam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course not. There are a couple of points that we need to take into consideration. First of all, when it comes to mourning and crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we need to pay attention to at least two aspects. One of them is emotion, and the other is the philosophy beyond mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. For the part of emotion, yes, some people say that it's 14 centuries, about 14 centuries have passed from the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, but still you are crying. But it's a matter of people crying for their emotions. Let me give you one example. So let's say, for example, a father passes away. So his children might cry for him a couple of weeks, and each year, maybe even for some decades, each year on the anniversary of his demise, they will remember him and they cry. And it's very normal, and it's very logical. Now imagine that their father doesn't die a natural death. Rather, he's brutally killed. So in the second case, for sure, his family members will cry for him more.
There's a difference between passing while sleeping at night very peacefully in bed and being not just murdered, but brutally murdered.
So when you remember how brutally your dear father was killed, from time to time you may remember him and cry for him. And nobody will call you, an insane person. Why do you cry for your father?
You're too sensitive.
Yeah, too sensitive.
No one would say that.
Yeah. And not only the children, then the next generation, when the grandchildren, they remember how their grandfather was brutally killed, they will also cry for him too. Let's add to that. Not only your father, your brothers are also brutally killed. Not only your brothers, your nephews and some of the close relatives. So for sure, in that case, many generations may come and cry for their forefathers and family members, who were many in number, and all of them, within a couple of hours, they were brutally killed. So I think even in the most secular societies, away from religious issues, if it happens for them, for some decades maybe, they will mourn, and at least whenever they remember those incidents, they will cry for them, and at least on the anniversaries of such an event.
They'll remember them, but also, as you said, even in the most secular society, they also, for example, they have movies in the theaters, or they read books who are sad books, like drama movies or sad tragedies, and they cry for something that is fake, not real, done by actors.
Yeah.
But we do not come and say, oh, you're crazy for crying because of this scene in this movie. No, because it is a human emotion, even if it's fake.
Yeah.
But this is very much real.
And the next point which adds to it is that now imagine your father, your brothers, and your nephews, and the other family members who were brutally killed were the most righteous human beings on the earth.
It just gets worse and worse as soon as you, of course.
Yeah, so it's another aspect. It's much different from, when your father, for example, was not a very good man and he was brutally killed, so you may cry for him for some time, but that, imagine, we are talking about the most righteous human beings on the earth. We are talking about an imam. We are talking about
best
our
presence on
best
creation.
People, yeah. So I would want to put emphasis on the fact that, we are not apologetic for that. Crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is related to our emotion too. Although 13, 14 centuries have passed, but 72 people who were the best human beings on the earth, were brutally martyred by the most wicked people. And then the family members, imagine that, I mean, sometimes your father is brutally killed, but your mother is highly respected by others, your sisters, your brothers. But on the plain of Karbala, on the tragedy of Karbala, right after killing Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the women, the kids are going to, I mean, they are somehow captured, arrested.
They were treated as slaves.
Slaves.
And this is the household of the Prophet.
That's
the Prophet of Islam, who made this Islamic community, this ummah. So it's not just a random family living in the desert.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam is of course a matter of emotion. We are not apologetic for that. We remember our Imam, we remember his brother Abul Fadl Abbas, his children, his nephews, his great companions, and the fact that we remember Lady Zainab salamullah alayha, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and all those kids and women who were went into captivity, I mean, with a very humiliating method. They were taken into different cities. So for sure, it's a matter of emotion, and we cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam because of the fact that I gave you some examples that it's very normal that if it happens in any other community, they will cry for them for centuries. And
it's a natural reaction.
Exactly. So this is the first point. The second point is that there are some philosophies for crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So one side is that it's related to emotion. But the second point is that when we talk about crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we have narrations in both Shia and Sunni narrations about the significance of crying. Of course, I will talk about the philosophy. But first of all, we need to know that the narrations of the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, the prophetic narrations in both Shia and Sunni narrations and the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt in Shia collections of hadith, they tell about the significance of crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Maybe it might be interesting to know about one such narration in Sunni sources. Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the great Sunni scholar, in the book Fada'il al-Sahaba, volume 2, page 675, he says that crying for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and all the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam has the reward of Jannah, paradise. And we know that there are many narrations about the importance of crying for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, even if it is only one drop of crying. And according to one narration, Imam al-Rida alayhi salam says that if you want to cry anything, then cry for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And not only crying, crying for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is so important that we have the concept of tabaki in the narrations. And
exactly.
Tabaki means that you're not able to cry, to somehow pretend that you are...
lower your head out of respect.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's a kind of respect for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So from this perspective, we have such narrations in our books which are telling us about the importance of crying for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and we are doing that every year. And the next point is about philosophy of crying. Is it only about emotions? No, it's not only about emotions. If it was only about emotions, I believe that we did not have all these narrations, such number of the narrations about the importance of even tabaki for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So these narrations give us a message that it is beyond emotions. It is about remembering Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the reason that he had his uprising.
Right.
Crying for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is crying for, oppression and justice.
Exactly.
The fact that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was martyred for the sake of preserving justice and for removing oppression and injustice from the Islamic society. So, I mean, we do not believe that it is only the matter of emotions. No. It's about emotion, and it's also about thinking about the philosophy of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I believe if we did not have these narrations about the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the importance of crying for him, gradually people would forget about Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the reasons that he had his uprising.
Which is perhaps more important. It is his uprising. That's the philosophy of
exactly.
It. We cry because of what he stood for.
Exactly. And we see that in the history of Islam, and especially the Shia school of thought, almost in all the cases that there was a kind of uprising by the justice-seeking people against the oppressive people, it was... they were inspired by Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And nowadays we see that back in 1979, the Islamic revolution of Iran was successful because of the revolution of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
It was an echo of his revolution.
Exactly. And there is a famous quote from Imam Khomeini alayhi rahmatullah alayhi in this regard. When we see the people of Lebanon, we know that they are inspired by Imam Hussein alayhi salam. People in Yemen, people in Iraq. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a great symbol for justice and for rising against oppression.
He is a representation of what Islam is.
Exactly. Very good. Greatly put. So crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we are not getting tired for that. First of all, as I mentioned, it is because of the emotions, and we are absolutely logical for that. Second of all, we have so many narrations in this regard. And third of all, there are philosophies for these narrations which are encouraging the people to remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam and cry for him. And as you mentioned, rightly mentioned, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the symbol of keeping Islam alive. So the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt rightly came to this point that the best way to remember the cause of Imam Hussein alayhi salam
is raw emotion.
Yeah, through emotions and crying and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And of course, people need to know that besides showing emotions, they need to remember the philosophy of the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, why Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred for. And I think this is one of the functions of these majalis that we hold every year.
Dear Sheikh, I thank you very much for your time and for your insightful information. I likewise thank our dear listeners for tuning in. This has been your host Musa Al-Bahadili coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Historically, the United States has emitted more carbon dioxide than any other country. The nation is responsible for more than a quarter of all carbon dioxide emitted since 1750s. As the world's second largest emitter, it is imperative that the U.S. federal government shift away from business as usual and take ambitious, concrete action to combat the climate crisis instead of kicking the can down the road. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kimberly White Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Environmental Groups Sue Biden Administration to Block Record Offshore Oil Lease Sale. Stay tuned for more. Environmental groups have joined together to challenge a controversial decision to lease out millions of acres of public waters for oil leasing. The Biden administration announced plans to open up millions of acres for oil and gas exploration in response to an order by a federal judge in Louisiana. While the Biden administration had paused oil and gas leasing on public lands and water, a Louisiana judge granted a preliminary injunction to 13 states, stating the government was obligated to offer acreage to the oil and gas industry and that the leasing pause would be economically damaging for the states. Environmental law organization Earth Justice has criticized the ruling as legally wrong, noting that while the order must be followed, the government is not legally required to return to business as usual. The federal government could choose to offer new oil and gas leases in a way that is limited and deliberate. The administration has appealed the judge's ruling but will proceed with new oil and gas leasing while the appeal is pending. Despite campaign promises to the contrary, the administration will offer 80 million acres of the Gulf of Mexico to the oil and gas industry, the largest offshore oil lease sale in the nation's history. Earth Justice has filed a lawsuit against Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland and the Bureau of Ocean Energy on behalf of Healthy Gulf, Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, and the Center for Biological Diversity. This lease sale is deeply disappointing. The Biden administration has folded to the oil industry based on its campaign of disinformation and political pressure, ignoring the worsening climate emergency we face, stated Brittany Hardy, Earth Justice attorney, adding, our planet cannot handle more stress from oil and gas production, and yet the Biden administration is plowing ahead with a lease sale that will have impacts for decades into the future. Earth
Chief Justice argues that the environmental analysis of Lee's sale 257 is out of date and relies on improper modeling to conclude that not having the lease sale will result in more greenhouse gases. Despite campaign promises to be climate and environmental justice champions, the Biden administration has opted to resume oil and gas lease sales, said Hallie Templeton, deputy legal director at Friends of the Earth, adding, to add insult to injury, federal officials have violated federal law by relying on outdated and flawed environmental analysis while continuing to treat the Gulf of Mexico as a sacrificial zone to big oil. The proposed sale would result in the production of up to 1.12 billion barrels and 4.4 trillion cubic fossil fuels over the next 50 years. The decision comes after the IPCC released its Code Red for Humanity report. The report noted that humankind has caused unprecedented warming and irreversibility, alerted the planet, providing a sobering reminder of the severity of the climate crisis and the urgent need for ambitious action. Global temperatures have already risen 1.2 degrees Celsius and continue to rise. The IPCC report shows that human activities are the primary driver of this rise and are responsible for roughly 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming since 1850 to 1900. Historically, the United States has emitted more carbon dioxide than any other country. The nation is responsible for more than a quarter of all carbon dioxide emitted since the 1750s. As the world's second largest emitter, it is imperative that the United States federal government shift away from business as usual and take ambitious, concrete action to combat the climate crisis instead of kicking the can down the road. We need to end offshore oil drilling, not burden future generations with this dirty and dangerous folly, said Kristen Munsell, Ocean Legal Director at the Center for Biological Diversity.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Youth Station here on IRIB English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio, I am honored to be joined by my brother in faith and humanity, Habib.
Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters.
Wa alaikum
as-salam.
Minna wa minkum. Likewise, brother, to you and to all our listeners. May Allah reward us all for every single drop of tear we shed for the sorrow of the son of Fatima, though that tear in itself is a reward.
And hopefully we'll avenge him.
Ameen, Ya Rab. With may Allah hasten in the reappearance of Sahib al-Asr wa Zaman. Imam al-Hussein.
Yeah.
He was Arab.
Salam Allah alayhi.
Right?
Yes.
Imagine if he were
British.
Roman. Or British even. But yeah, imagine if he was blonde, fair skin, blue eyes. Or he was a Western figure.
All right.
Because, you know, Jesus Christ wasn't blonde with fair hair and blue eyes. He was Middle Eastern. But he slowly but surely turned into a Western figure. And Christianity became a Western religion.
White culture.
White culture. Whitewashed, as they did with the Prophet of God. And every commemoration done regarding Jesus Christ is done within the Western culture. right? I mean, Thanksgiving is the most American thing ever, yet it is within a Christian context.
I thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he...
That Imam al-Hussein wasn't...
Yeah, it wasn't a Western figure.
But what if he was?
If
Karbala was a Western event? How do you think
There are TV shows that make fun of God, the Creator, the Almighty. There are TV shows that make fun of everything. I personally believe that if Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a Western figure, he would have dark humor, you know.
Yeah, the same way you see about Jesus Christ or Nabi Musa alayhi salam.
That's one thing. Another thing, we would see a lot of plays about him, something that you don't like, sister.
You would enjoy. But imagine if Hollywood could mix. You've watched A Passion of Christ, right? By Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
It was epic. Dude, I know that Nabi Isa alayhi salam wasn't crucified. I watched Passion of Christ. I cried like a baby.
Oh.
Right? Well, not like a baby, but I cried. Imagine if Hollywood could make movies about Abu Abdullah.
Yeah, it's not like the Arabs. The Arabs, you know, people in the Middle East, right? We talked about this before. They have their own method of remembering Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Other than that, I think, unfortunately, during this era specifically, studying Imam Hussein alayhi salam altogether has become fallen weak. You know, we've taken into submission about some ideas, and then we just accept them and go on with our lives.
Mm.
Right? Who told you that Imam Hussein alayhi salam wanted to do a revolt?
What does that have to do with Imam Hussein being Arab and not Western?
That's what I'm saying here. People in the West are slow, are always study. They always, you know, have this critical thinking in them.
True.
And unfortunately, in this era, I feel like that this critical thinking is not that strong.
Mm.
And whatever you hear, you just accept. And for example, they might even make up stories, you know, that have no truth to it. And they're just using any method just to make people cry. And it just opens up the door, you know, for using it in bad ways.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that would be one of the pros of Imam al-Hussein being a Western figure. There would be a lot of critical, scientific, academic analysis of his movement. People would recognize him and connect with him perhaps on a higher level. It wouldn't merely rest on sentimentality and this little tradition, you know, once a year tradition. Though I think it's a wonderful tradition. It's like better than nothing, but it's not enough. It's definitely not enough. And sometimes I feel, unfortunately, whether it's our own fault or it's the fault of capitalism or colonizers.
I think it's culture as well, because there's a different... I don't think that there will be a lot of crying. If it was...
Yeah, definitely. The Western...
Yeah. I've seen a Western person lose his mother and father.
But they're like poker face.
Poker face.
Unbothered.
I've seen a man lose his uncle's friend, and he was beating himself.
Here?
Here.
In the Middle East.
Yeah, in the Middle East. At the end of the day.
You're one of those people, aren't you?
Yes.
Will you cry if I die?
Depends.
On? If I owe you money?
Depends. It depends.
Okay.
How you are, Sister Zainab, the one that loves Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and yes, I'll try
to cry.
And you know, but
I'll rub some onions in my ear.
Are you gonna cry if I die?
Why don't you die first, and I'll decide.
I was gonna do the same thing to you, but I didn't do it because I wanted to be nice for once in my life. I failed.
I think you're totally right. Not much crying would be involved because the Western people, I think, aren't very in touch with those sort of feelings. I don't know for what, which is interesting because I was reading a statement by Ayatollah Javadi Amali. May Allah prolong his life. This man is a gem.
Right.
And he was saying that a society which actively and easily mourns for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is a compassionate society. In such a society where people's hearts are softened by constant mourning and crying for Imam al-Hussein, there will be less crimes, less death, less oppression, less trampling of rights, because this society has a soft heart, has a compassionate heart. No, in every sense of the word.
If there is true crying, there is true
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying hypocritical crocodile tears. Yes. I'm saying actual crying. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
La chalabash yabna zahra ashurahis labbaykema la chalabash yabna zahra ashurahis labbaykema labbayka ya Hussein labbayka ya
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab and my co-host,
Brother Habib, at your service.
A lot of people, they might be over the top, sometimes unreasonable in many fields of their lives, which results in a lot of problems and conflicts to occur in their lives. But because of this compassion, which has been developed within them through the love of Imam al-Hussein, they back off, they simmer down, they have this line, you know, they have this boundary. And the moment you mention Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to them, I've seen a lot, especially Middle Eastern people, they're yelling and then the guy is pulling out his Spartan sword and someone mentions Abul Fadl al-Abbas, everyone calms down, dead silence. And I think that's a good thing. Western societies, a lot of them, don't have such a boundary.
It's cultural.
Yeah, it's a beautiful culture. We're blessed to have this culture. There are a lot of other pros and cons to this.
The dining aspect.
The dining
that's,
aspect.
That's one thing that really I want to see. Because Arabs, I'm not saying that, you know.
You're looking for Western something people. Other than qeem and najafi?
Yes.
Like turkey, meatloaf, pizza?
Yes, pizza. Actually, there was my mother actually, yeah.
She gave out pizza?
I just want to say that the Middle Eastern people have this more generous part. You know, and I'm not saying this out of, you know, being biased or anything.
Racist.
But I haven't seen anyone give out tacos in the name of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
I have.
Who are they? Were they Arabs or the non-Arabs?
No, in the Western culture.
Western culture?
Yeah. So or even Southeast Asian cultures. Maybe not taco, but, you know, their own food. Arabs are known for their generosity, bro. Some of them, at least, those who remember to give their sister in faith yummy food every year in the name of Imam al-Hussein. Anyway, what other cultural differences do you think you'd notice if Imam al-Hussein was a Western man?
The way that he will be remembered as well.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that we forget that there was a battle. You know, sometimes we go so into deep about the, you know, sorrow parts and that he was, you know, that we forget the idea that there was a war.
Like the epicness of it?
Yes. Like, I don't know, I feel like our sorrow, our grief kind of, you know,
it
overpowers the fact that there was war, there were kufis, there were, like, for example, people from the Basra, why didn't this person come, or what happened to that? You know, that war aspect, that tactical, you could say, aspect to it.
Yeah, for sure, definitely, yeah.
Because you would have seen books and maps about...
But we don't have that much.
About history? Our history books are full about details. Especially if you go back and read the beginning of Kufa, for example, to understand Kufa and its historical part in the Islamic military aspect. And you could see that it was very important the way that the Arabs would live, you know, off of the government, and the rest of the people who were non-Arabs would live by, you know, buying and trading and stuff like that. So I think that going back to that concept of studying the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam more.
Oh, another thing that I think would be different is that, you know how in the Middle Eastern culture, but people usually only wear black when they're mourning. But in the West, black is sometimes just a fashion statement.
It's become a fashion statement here as well.
Has it?
It has. You know, having a black car, a black watch and stuff
like clothes,
that.
But clothes.
But still, it remains black.
Black
is the color of
mourning.
Mourning.
But it's not necessarily like that in the or even in Southeast Asian countries.
I know African countries that wear whites.
When they mourn?
But I also know Arab countries. When I know Arab tribes, they wear white.
Which
as well.
Wear Arab tribes?
In our, this era as well. Bani Amr.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The subcontinent, they wear white.
Yeah.
Especially the Hindus.
Yeah.
Southeast Asians, they have no adherence for black attire during their mourning whatsoever.
Oh.
But I think that would also be a factor. And there would probably be like a village somewhere in one of these Western countries. You know, the Amish people, there would probably be this village somewhere in the Western countries where they still live their life the way Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did, untouched by the passing of ages and centuries, trying to stay connected to their Husseini roots. Somewhere in the hills, the
Habib
Alp hills. Yeah, yeah, probably. Every summer, Brother Habib would take a vacation, go on a vacation to that village, stay with them, take pictures, post it on Instagram. I'm not saying that the Middle Eastern culture has done a perfect job at commemorating, celebrating, and raising awareness regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
How about the visiting Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam?
You mean like the shrine?
Will it be like a museum where you have to pay money?
Definitely a museum.
Money?
For sure.
Fee?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Entrance
capitalism,
fee.
Hello.
All right.
They have to like, they have to milk everything.
Would they name their shops after Imam
Al-Hussein? After Imam
al-Hussein. Would they do it?
We are doing it too.
We are doing
we
it.
We have streets and
we have
shops.
We have falafel Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have mixed feelings about that.
Really?
Mm. Streets, too, named after
yeah.
Imam al-Hussein. I'm not comfortable with it.
The streets, but I think that, in the Western culture, they do name streets after, you know, important people, important figures.
Yeah.
Human beings are so similar in many aspects, you know?
Yet so different in many other.
Yeah.
I think that's all the time we have for today's episode.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, give it a thought. You can't let us know about your opinions, but share it among yourselves, okay, how it would be different. And that's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Until next time, on behalf of myself and the cast and crew, I bid you goodbye and farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love, my love is strong.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran, You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.